And a happy good evening to you. My name is Paul, and I am a reborn alcoholic. And I am delighted to be here. I'm delighted that Max, my favorite Al-Anon, is here. And I'm delighted you're here. In fact, it'd be kind of a dull meeting if you weren't. In fact, I'm delighted to be anywhere. I'm delighted to be me today, and that beats trying to figure out ways to kill myself, which is what it used to be like. So it's been a great event for Max and I to be here. I think this is the way a conference and convention ought to be run, and I think everybody who's worked on this, and there's a lot of work to put one of these on, we ought to reward them all with at least another 24 hours of sobriety. And in fact, I think we ought to give them a hand. I don't mean to do that. It's been a great convention up to this point. I hope it has enough momentum to carry itself for the next hour. I hope none of you have too much trouble with all that coffee you've drunk. I noticed they commented on the bladder effect of coffee. I also noticed that the meetings here are a bit shorter than I'm used to back home. I assume that was established by somebody with bladder problems. I identify with anybody with bladder problems. I happen to have been born with the world's most bashful bladder. And I've been around AA long enough to hear a lot of stories, a lot of sad stories, but there's nothing sadder than an alcoholic with a bashful bladder. In fact, I would keep coming to these meetings and working these steps and reading this book, even if I wasn't staying sober, if it would just keep on helping me with my bladder the way it had. Hasn't really helped my capacity particularly, but my aim has improved tremendously. Another thing I noticed in my home groups, I have three of them now. We start them off with a show of hands, and I haven't noticed that here, and I miss it. We start out with having a show of hands of all the alcoholics. It's a little dark out there, but I'd like to see the hand of every alcoholic in the audience. Would you raise your hand, please? Fantastic. We have a quorum. We can go on with the meeting now. Yeah. And then there's those other people. The Al-Anons. Could we see the hands of the Al-Anons, please? Oh, let's give them a hand. That's enough. That's enough. It's easy to spoil them. I always like to see Al-Anons at meetings, any kind of meeting. I think they need all the meetings they can get. I also get the impression that more Al-Anons are more likely to come to AA functions than AA people go into Al-Anon functions. And I don't know why that is particularly. I have a lot of respect for Al-Anon. I've gone to a lot of Al-Anon meetings. The most recent one was last night. In fact, I saw it for the first time at this convention, so I saw that new pamphlet, Double Winners. And for AA members who are married to AA members who can be a winner in both programs. And if you're married to an alcoholic, whether they're sober or not, if you're not going down on, you're missing something, in my opinion. So anyway, what about the newcomers? Let's have a newcomer in our home group is defined as anybody with less than 30 days of sobriety. I don't know how that works at a convention. Could we see the hands of anybody with less than 30 days sobriety? Would you raise your hand, please? Over here, back there. Well, I can guarantee you, you're going to stay sober. If you're willing to put your hand up in the midst of all these people and identify yourself as a newcomer, if you're willing to follow instructions on this program, you're going to stay sober. And I also want to welcome those of you who didn't put your hand up. And I'm happy to tell you that you're going to make it too, because you're my kind of alcoholic. I didn't put my hand up either. I didn't think it was anybody's business. Anyhow, I guess I'm supposed to talk about what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. What it was like is the drunkalog. I happen to have an absolutely fascinating drunkalog. And it's a very dangerous thing for me to talk about, because once I get into it, I get so fascinated that I end up taking the collection up, and I haven't become an alcoholic yet. And then, I have to be careful not to get too fascinated. The main thing was that really I wasn't, as Joe said, I wasn't an alcoholic. I was never meant to be an alcoholic, never set out to be an alcoholic, never occurred to me to be an alcoholic. My mother never suggested when I grew up I might want to become president of AA, and no school sponsor ever suggested, maybe you'd like to be an alcoholic. I don't think I even look like an alcoholic, except when I'm drinking. And didn't even really have that much of a drinking problem. Basically, I had a lot of marital problems. Really? I mean, this Max, it looks like a very saintly gal, but, she drove me to drink for a long time. December 2nd, I guess, we'll be, 38 years married. And that's a long time. And it started out as a real good marriage. It really, really did. But it kind of deteriorated as she went through the various stages of Al-Anonism. Yeah. Wasn't too bad at first. She began to complain that I didn't like her. You don't like me, why don't you admit it? And then later on she was saying, you don't love me, why don't you admit you don't love me? And as her disease was beginning to reach the terminal stages, she was screaming at me, you hate me, why don't you admit you hate me? And so I admitted it. I remember saying to her, I said, there's only one person in the world whose guts I hate worse than yours, and that's my own. And as I recall, she cried a little bit, and she went to bed, because going to bed was the only thing she knew at that time with her problems. I cried a little bit, and I mixed me another drink. And you know, the funny part was, I'm sure it wasn't that I didn't care. If anything, I think I cared too much. And I think that's characteristic of us, that we may act like we don't care, and we may act like we don't have any morals, but I think, if anything, we care too much, and we are actually puritanical. But alcohol makes us do funny things. Basically, that's what I mean when I say I'm an alcoholic. I mean that I react peculiarly to the drug alcohol. And therein lies my story, as a matter of fact. At that time, I didn't care. I tried hard to help her. I could see the things happening to her. And I cared, and I was, I felt responsible, and I wanted to help, and I worked. I devoted myself to the job of helping her. I used to send her to psychology classes, and women's improvement things. I used to read her positive thinking books. Got her a Charles Simmons positive thinking correspondence course. He was very prominent positive thinker out in our area, right up to the day where they arrested him for embezzlement. Don't hear much about Charlie anymore. I thought maybe hypnosis would help her. And I took a course in hypnosis, and turned out she wasn't a very good subject. I was so anxious to help, I ended up taking 6 courses in hypnosis, and I ended up a drunken hypnotist. I used to send her to a psychiatrist. Not just one, I think it was at least 4 consecutive psychiatrists. And at one time she was going to psychiatrist, our 2 adopted daughters were going to clinical psychologists. And she was bringing the dog home with psychological interpretations. I remember one day being furious, and I was screaming at her, and I said, what do you mean? I said, you tell that stupid cat and dog doctor that he's not a Beverly Hills psychiatrist. All I want to know is, why does that dog wet in my lap when I'm holding him? And you know, that dog hasn't wet my pants since I joined AA. And neither have I. I did all kinds of things to try to help her. And actually, the harder I worked on her, the sicker she got. And she got so sick that when it ended up at the psycho ward, I wasn't really surprised. But when that steel door slammed shut and she was the one that went home, I was amazed. Besides having marital problems and a lot of other problems, I had a lot of trouble with insomnia. I have the world's worst case of insomnia, no question about it. I was born with it. I used to worry all day about whether or not I was going to sleep at night. I used to worry all night about whether I was going to sleep at night. And I really worked on it. When I had a problem, I worked on it. I wasn't slovenly about anything. I thought that when you have a problem, you work on it. And if at first you don't succeed, the fact that you failed proved that you didn't try hard enough, dummy. So try it again, the same way. Don't change anything. Do the same thing over and over and over again, harder. And so I worked on my sleeping problem. And I, sleeping pills, the obvious thing would be to take sleeping pills, but they didn't work until the next day. Tranquilizers hadn't really been invented yet, except they, Milltown came around, you couldn't get them, they were scarce, and they were supposed to be not a sedative like a sleeping pill, but a tranquilizer. It's supposed to make you normal. And if you're too fine, too high, it would normalize you, but it wouldn't sedate you. I got to where I was taking 6 at a time, and I didn't feel any effect of them, so I figured that proved I was normal to start with. It was my own little Rorschach test, or psychological. So I didn't think much of Milltown. And the only thing that really would put me to sleep, or help me to sleep, was to drink a couple of beers. I was going to pharmacy school at the time. And I had found that if I would go to school all day and work in a drugstore all night and then study till midnight, 1, 2 o'clock, or whatever, and then I'd go to bed, everything I had been studying would be running through my head. And I'd be half awake and half asleep. And in the morning, I'd be both tired and stupid. And I found out that if I drank a couple of beers right at the end of the study period, I could jump in bed, sleep real fast, and wake up smart. And that was the way I went through pharmacy school. And then I went on into graduate school, and then medical school, and then specialty training and private practice. And all the time, I was drinking more and more and more. And I thought that it was because my responsibilities were increasing. If you had my responsibilities, you'd drink too. And that was my... I don't mean to... Anything I say tonight that tries to explain to you why I drank, I don't want you to believe it. Because I don't think I don't have any idea. I thought that was one of the first things you're supposed to learn when you come to AA. You tell someone to figure out why you drank. And I have a list about a mile long of reasons why I drank. The longer I'm sober, the more things I remember. And actually, I've come to the conclusion I drank because I'm an alcoholic, and that's what alcoholics do. And every drink I ever took, it seemed like a good idea at the time. And I may have rationalized why I took it, but I don't really know why an alcoholic drinks, but I think that's alcoholism. And having said all that profundity, I forget where I was. But I used to, as I say, work on getting to sleep. I got to where I was taking intravenous pentothal. I don't know if you have, you know what I mean, but out back where I come from, they used to have storefronts that would say, oral surgeon, pentothal given. That's just the barbiturate, where they put the stuff in the syringe and they put the needle in your vein, and they say, count to 10, and you say 1, and zing, you're asleep. Instant blackout. It's fantastic, really. I just love that. So I used to squirt that in my veins and put me to sleep. It was complicated in the sense that I couldn't go down to the office and put me to sleep and then drive home and go to bed. And it just didn't seem right for me to lie there in bed with a needle in my vein and my one daughter, Paula, saying, hey, Ann, come watch Daddy take his nightly fix. So I would keep my pentothal in my bag, and the bag in the car, and the car in the garage, and the garage, luckily, was attached to the house. And after a hard day's work and a hard evening's drinking and a day of pill taking, I would go out there and mix up the stuff and put the needle in my vein and try to figure out, now, how much is the amount that I can squirt in, take it out, take care of it, throw it in the bag, throw the bag in the car, slam the car door, run down the hall, and jump in bed so I could fall asleep? It's hard to judge it. If I got too much, I just zing right under the car. What that meant, it resulted in a greasy black and blue spot. And I already had so many black and blue spots I couldn't explain that adding greasy ones didn't complicate that too much, but it wasn't too practical. The worst part was, if I didn't get quite enough, I'd squirt it and take it out, throw it in the bag, throw the bag in the car, slam the car door, run down the hall, jump in bed, and nothing would happen. And that would make me furious, and I'd have to go back and try it over again, or I'd get drunk to do it and to get to sleep. But the biggest factor about that was, well, one of the other things was that when you start running, you know, I couldn't put a Band-Aid over my arm, or I couldn't keep it held up like this till the blood clotted and all that. So what I would do is pull my arm up like this and do all this other stuff with one hand, hoping gravity would take care of that. And I'd run down the hall like this, and then I'd run into Max, and I'd try to act casual, you know. And it's hard to be casual when you're in a hurry like that. Actually, the worst thing about it, though, was it didn't last long. It was instant blackout. It was fast asleep, and it was fast awake. And I one time had to put myself back to sleep 3 times during that one night, and I decided that was kind of dumb and ought to quit that. And you know, I couldn't quit doing that until I didn't have any of it around. I had to force myself to not buy anymore, because if I had it there, I would use it. My problem was, if I didn't have any there, I'd go get some. And it was the same way with my drinking. I never was able to quit drinking until I could quit having it there. I couldn't have it in the house and not drink it, and it was hard to not have it in the house because house didn't seem like a house without some liquor there. And I did, and it was the same way with pills. I can't have pills around. I can't have tranquilizers around, even for emergencies. I can't say I'm not going to take this unless I really, really, really need it. Because if I say that, I might as well go take it, because I'm going to really, really, really need it. I never once took a pill because I was a pill head. Every pill I ever took, I took because I had the symptom. I either had it or I could feel it coming on. I had the symptom that only that pill would take care of. So every pill, almost like every drink, that I ever took was medically indicated at the time and prescribed by a doctor and dispensed by a pharmacist, me. It got, the days were bad and the nights were worse. And it got to where it was kind of hard to get up in the morning. But I never became a morning drinker. I would have no respect for a doctor who would drink on the job. So I had a 5 a.m. shut-off time. If it was 1 minute to five, I'd drink myself back to sleep. And if it was 5 o'clock or after, I'd just stay up and act like a martyr all day. But it became hard to work, hard to go. I had the flu a lot at that time. And one day I said to myself, my gosh, what would you do for a patient that felt like this? And the answer came right back. I'd give him something to pep him up. And so I started taking something to pep me up. And well, I started with appetite appeasers. You know, that's the upper and the downer in it. And one day I asked myself, what are you taking any downer for when you're trying to get upper? And so I was taking straight amphetamines and straight Benzedrine. And it worked wonders. I was a practicing alcoholic, which is a full-time job. If you haven't tried it, you know. And being a practicing physician is kind of a full-time. I was a practicing alcoholic physician, so I really need something to keep me on my feet, and the amphetamines really worked. I'm very grateful to how they kept me going to get to the bottom. I don't know. They did have... one thing they did was to affect my hearing. I couldn't listen fast enough to hear what I was saying a lot of times. I think, my God, I wonder why I'm saying that again. I've already said it 3 times. I do a lot of physical exams as an internist. And when I examine men, I have them take off everything but their shorts. When I examine women, I have them take off everything. And I give them a little plastic thing that hangs down. It has no sleeves in it, but they put their arms through a couple holes, and it hangs down from them, and they feel like they got something on, and they sit at a table facing this way. And I stand on this side, and I examine their eyes, ears, nose, throat, and neck, and I take a little plastic thing, and I drop it down, and they're sitting there topless, and then I immediately put my right hand over their left breast, and I always say, do you examine your breasts regularly for lumps? Now, it always has one of two effects, always the same. They either say, oh my gosh, my last doctor told me to do that, and I used to do that, but I never found any lumps, so I decided I wasn't doing it right, so I stopped doing it, but I ought to be doing it. Or they say, oh no, my last doctor told me to do that, but I don't want any lumps in my breast, so I don't want to find any, so I don't examine my breast. But either way, they're thinking of the scientific aspect of why some man is standing there with his hand on their breast, and it's just real good bedside manner. So I never put my hand on a woman's breast without saying, you examine your breast regularly for lumps. It's always worked very well for me. I don't know what you're thinking about. You might want to check the morale of this audience. Anyway, one day I went to work, and I had the flu, but I went to work anyhow at the aid of a few little pills, and I was examining this gal, and she was rather small, and she wasn't at all well endowed in that department. And I examined her eyes, ears, nose, throat, and neck, and I dropped a little thing down. I put my right hand over left nubbin. And I looked at her very solicitously, and I said, do you examine your lumps regularly for breasts? Yeah. Actually, this program has helped my practice a lot of ways. One day I, twice I decided not to take anything to get to sleep. It was a weekend, both times. And I decided I wouldn't drink, I wouldn't take any pills, I wouldn't use any narcotics. I took narcotics too. I guess I explained why I drank and why I took the pills. And then the narcotics, I just kind of took those as between meal nourishments or something. I just love intravenous Demerol. It's just really, really great stuff. I think that's fantastic. As a matter of fact, if any of you are planning a slip, try to get some intravenous Demerol before you get back. It's not worth going out after, but if you're going to be out there anyway, you might try it. It's good stuff. Anyway, I decided not to take anything and see what would happen. And both times, Sunday morning, same thing happened. I had a convulsion. My reaction to that was, well, I didn't drink last night, so alcohol couldn't have anything to do with it. And I was was sent to a neurologist, a specialist in convulsive disorders, and he didn't think to ask me if I drank, and I didn't think to tell him. And he couldn't figure out why I had convulsions, and he ended up deciding I ought to go to the Mayo Clinic. And I thought what I needed was a consultation with a good internist. And I happened to be the best internist I knew at the time. And I knew my case better than anybody I knew. And I had a conference with me and could see the change of personality and the daily headaches and the sense of impending disaster and the things that were going on. And it was obvious. It was suddenly very obvious that well, I had a brain tumor, and I'd die and you'd all be sorry. And I took Max to an attorney, and I signed a power of attorney, turning everything over to her, and went off to the Mayo Clinic. And after 9 days of tests and that, they stuck me in the nut ward. And that's where the steel door slammed shut. I just found out 2 years ago that she went and told them all about the pills. It took her that long before she had nerve enough to admit that she had told them about it. And I was being treated like I was crazy. And I didn't like that at all. In fact, I signed out of there against medical advice. I had to, the way you do that, you have to have somebody assume responsibility for you, and the only one around to do that was Max. And she wasn't being very cooperative. And I finally made the ultimate threat. I told her I'd never speak to her again if she didn't do it, so she done it. After I promised never to ever drink again or take a pill again or talk to girls again or swear again or anything else. And I had a hard time signing my name because a jerk doctor watched me. And I by that time I couldn't write if anybody watched me. It was hard enough to write so I could read it if it didn't watch me. In fact, I've got pages of notes of stuff at home that I had to try to rewrite. A lot of it I couldn't rewrite for medical legal reasons. A lot of it I couldn't even rewrite, couldn't read my own writing. And I have stacks of that to remind me of what it was like back in 1966. In fact, as the years went by, you could see my writing deteriorate up to the end of 1966. And then there was a blank period of, I think, about 3 months when I wasn't around. When another doctor took over my practice, he came out of nowhere and took over my office and worked while I was gone and went to AA. And when I came back, then the change in my writing was dramatic. Some people say they still can't read it, but it's dramatic to me. But anyhow, I made Max all these promises and got out of there, and we got on the airplane and immediately had a big fight over whether or not I was going to drink the free booze. It just seemed to me that it was kind of sinful to not drink it. I'd paid for it. And we fought about it. She won. I didn't drink. But by God, I wouldn't talk and I wouldn't eat either. And that's the way Max and I and our two daughters spent Christmas Day 1966, flying back to California where I'd be treated with more respect. I got back home and got a bottle and started drinking, and I ended up in the hospital. She called the neurologist, told him about the psychiatric ward. He said, I better see a psychiatrist there. And I ended up being put in the hospital in the nut ward of the hospital I was on the staff of. That's embarrassing. No. If you're on the staff of the hospital of the nut ward you're being put into and you fight hard enough, you get a private room. And I didn't like it there. I'd never been taught in medical school how to act on the nut ward when you're a patient, or how to be humble. I was trying to be humble, and I didn't know how to be humble on the nut ward. I didn't know what the routine was. I didn't know what else I was supposed to be doing. I know I got furious because they wanted me to make leather belts. It just didn't appeal to me. It just didn't seem like I'd gone to school all those years so that I could sit there and make leather belts. And besides, I didn't understand the instructions. And you know, it's a funny thing. I've never been able to figure it out. But not long after that, I started going to AA meetings, and I've been to a lot of AA meetings since. And I've never been to one where they taught anything about occupational therapy. And yet, after I had been to not many AA meetings, I went back to that hospital, and I made the most beautiful pair of moccasins you've ever seen. Really, real beautiful moccasins. They not only looked good, but they felt good. And when I got out of the hospital, I used to get home from work, and the first thing I do is take off my tie and mix a drink. I got to where I get home, and I take off my tie and my shoes, and I put on my moccasins. And I would wear my moccasins around all evening, and go out to get gas or go to the store or go out around the patio. I'd wear my moccasins. I loved those moccasins. And they would, the tongue, whatever, would break, and I'd tie it and patch it up together. It took 7 years before those moccasins wore out. And I felt bad when they wore out. Not bad enough to go back and get another pair, but... and for my 7th AA birthday, my dear Al-Anon wife had my moccasins bronzed. And I love my bronze moccasins. And as long as I remember where I got them, I don't have to go back and make another pair. They're not near as comfortable now, though. Before I started making the moccasins and was trying to figure out how to spend my time in the nut ward, what I did basically was I spent my time writing lists of things for Max to do in order. See, Max had worked in the office with me, been my secretary for all those years. And I used to write letters and lists and orders of things for her to do on how to keep the world running while I was locked up in the nut ward. You obviously have to be kind of nutty to do that. Of course, you have to be even nuttier to come back every morning for a new list like she did. What time am I supposed to quit? Quarter after? That was my life. I used to pollute the environment. I used to try environmental control. I divided everything into the external environment, which was everything outside myself, and the internal environment, which was everything inside my skin. It was how I felt. Like when you wake up in the middle of the night and the whole world's asleep, but you, then you're living in the internal environment. I used to try to control the entire external environment. People, places, things, situations, institutions. I thought if I could control them, I would feel good on the inside. And somebody, usually Max, was always screwing it up. And by controlling the external didn't take care of it, I tried to control the internal by putting chemicals in. And when I would get side effects from those chemicals, I'd take other chemicals to counteract the side effects of the chemicals I was taking. So I was really a pharmacist practicing on myself. So it was better living through chemistry was a way of life with me. And what I've done since coming to AA, I've made the smartest business decision I've ever made. I gave up a controlling interest in my life. And God doesn't work for me anymore. I work for Him. He's the director. He's the, what do they call it, general partner, and I'm the silent partner. We've divided it up. I do the work and He does the worry. In fact, when things get bad, it doesn't even help for me to help Him worry. It just makes it worse. He can handle it much better Himself. We have an agreement. I pedal and I say, I'll pedal and you steer. And for God's sake, watch where you're going. I'm sick of some of the places we've been, you know. So I have a new director to my life, but I wouldn't want to give you the impression that I got to AA and immediately did that. I was taken to these AA meetings. I remember the day that I was sitting there in the nut ward, commiserating with myself of the series of misunderstandings and the things that had gone wrong and the fact that nobody understood me. And what was a nice guy like me doing in a place like this anyway? And the psychiatrist came walking up behind me and he said, how would you like to talk to a man from AA? And you know, I didn't have the vaguest notion of how I could be any help to some drunk from AA. I thought maybe he wanted me to learn something about alcoholism while I was putting in my time there. One thing I could tell very clearly, this guy, I could just see by the look on his face that he'd just be delighted if I said yes. I could just see that that's what he wanted me to say. And I, having signed out of one place and not wanting to sign out of another one, I wanted to please this guy. And for no other reason than happiness is a happy psychiatrist. I wanted to make him happy. And so I said yes. And it seems like no time at all before I realized that was a dumb thing to say. This clown came galloping into the room screaming, my name is Frank and I'm an alcoholic, ha, 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 ha. And I thought, oh my God. I felt sorry for him. The only thing in life he had to brag about was the fact that he was an alcoholic. And such a loud voice. And he was yelling about being alcoholic, Alcoholics Anonymous, and waving the book. And I would think, why don't you lower your voice, man? These people all think I'm a nut. Why don't we leave it at that, you know? It was a pitiful situation. It had an interminable story. It went on forever. I don't remember anything he said until I remember he finally said, well, that's my story. I'm going to a meeting tonight. Would you like to go along? And I said, hell no, I won't like it. I won't like it, but I'll go to please that dumb psychiatrist. And he took me to some meetings. And I've heard beautiful pitches by people describing their first meeting, and I think they're delightful. I congratulate you on remembering. I don't have any idea how many meetings I was taken to before I knew what meeting I was at. And I don't remember anything about my first meeting. I do recall that it had a tremendous effect on the psychiatrist. He was delighted. He now was very interested in me and spent a lot of time talking to me. And just before coming here, this last weekend, I was at Joe mentioned International Doctors in AA Convention, and I was on a panel. There's three of us, talked briefly, and one of the other three of us was a doctor who the same psychiatrist had sent to me or called me when he was in the hospital, same place I was, saying that he had tried AA and hadn't made it, but would I come and take them to some meetings to see if he'd make it now? And I thought to myself, well, he may not make it this time either, but my God, he's going to get to some meetings. I was still trying to impress the psychiatrist, so I wanted to see how many meetings I could get that guy to. This was 9 months after I'd first been pushed into AA. And I took that guy to 9 meetings in 1 week, and on a Sunday, we got to Mass, a short 12-step call, and 3 meetings. And when I took him back to the hospital that night, he was tired. And you know, that guy never, at that time, he didn't make the program either. But my program has never been the same since. I've never gone back to as few meetings. I used to go to 1 meeting a week, whether I needed it or not. And I still, to this day, go to 3 and 4 and 5 every week. But that guy, that doctor was on this panel with me, and the third of the three of us was the guy who called me when he first was trying to get help, and the leader of the meeting was a guy who calls me sponsor. And it occurred to me that there were 4 of us. And it all come through this one psychiatrist that, as a result of the psychiatrist capturing me. The point being, I got that kind of screwed up, but don't. The point being that the psychiatrist was not an alcoholic. I asked him one time, you know, what are you all time sending people, how do you come about sending people to AA? And what happened was that when he was an intern, before he went into psychiatry, during his internship, part of the job was that he had to go to 1 AA meeting. He went to 1 AA meeting, and now his chief interest in life is to run around with his butterfly net and capture alcoholics. Just like me. And he sends them to AA. He won't even see them. He just sends them to AA until they get addicted to these things. These meetings, and then he won't see him anymore, and he turns them loose to AA until maybe a year later or so. If they're still having problems, then he'll see him and try to help them with their psychiatric problems. But I'm impressed with the fact of what happened as a result of one man going to one meeting. In fact, I'm very impressed with this, of the power of this program and the miracles. I'm just really, in fact, I feel like a miracle maker. Now, I don't perform miracles, but as a result of things I do, I can watch a miracle happen. I'm impressed with the miracle. I'll never get tired of AA because I don't listen to the drunkologues. I don't listen to the details. I listen to the things that happen, the people. The things that happen to people. I remember Wilma. Wilma was talking about her drinking. She was a drunken woman, a daily drunk. And she was dating this guy. And she was going to meet him in a bar. And she was sitting there drinking and waiting for him, and he was late. And finally he came in and he apologized for being late. And he says, I really have to apologize to you. He says, I have to tell you, I'm an alcoholic. And I can't go with you tonight. I got to go get back to AA. I'm going to a meeting. Right now, he says, would you like to come along? He says, oh, what the hell. She put on her gloves and went with him. Hasn't had a drink today, yet, ever since. You know, to me, that's impressive. You hear it all the time. A man drunk 30, 40 years, comes to AA, never has another drink. You know, dies sober. I think it's fantastic. And I'm a part of that. I'm a part of that. Again, I have the feeling that I don't want to give you the impression that I, the psychiatrist said, why don't you go to AA, and I went and I found all this. I was taking the meetings and I heard a lot of dumb things. I was ashamed the day that a big, strapping, healthy young man stood up there at the podium and he said, if I don't take a drink today, I'm a success today. I am God Almighty. I got 1,000 things I got to do today before I can brag about not taking a drink, for God's sake. Of course, I was still drinking at the time. And yet, you know, not taking a drink is the most important thing I do. It's the most important thing I do today. I have my goals. I have very precise goals. And the number one goal is to keep me sober today. There's absolutely nothing that I am not willing to do, nothing that I'm not willing to put up with for me to stay sober today. And I'm thoroughly convinced that if I don't take a drink today, I'm a success today, no matter what. No matter what anybody thinks, no matter what I think, I'm a success if I don't drink today. And as a result of that, the other goals can be accomplished in that. Things like, how much are you adding to the total love in the world today? Somehow that's a phrase or a question that's very meaningful to me. Let it begin with love. Couldn't begin with love with me. I was taken to my home group in Laguna Beach, and the reason I had to go to Laguna Beach is because it was 35 miles from home, and I thought I could go down there and I wouldn't run into anybody I knew. And now, 10 and a half years later, I've gone to Laguna Beach long enough that I've run into everybody that goes to Laguna Beach, so they won't run into anybody they know. And I went down there, and that's a very loving group, and they talk about love a lot, and they do a lot of hugging and kissing and rubbing and bumping, and it just scared the devil out of me. It just frightened me when anybody talked about love, and I began to make some progress in that department when somebody defined love from the podium, and that was Don G, and he said that love to him meant wishing you well and being willing to take some action to help you to achieve it. Somebody else said love meant action. It's action. It's doing something for another person. Just wishing them well and helping them to achieve it. The other day I was reading some things about how to get along with your spouse. And if you're having trouble, I can give you two rules that I'm trying to apply. One is three C's. Don't criticize, condemn, or complain. Or if you like a phrase out of the book, there's a sentence that says, arguments and fault-finding should be avoided like the plague. And it's not in any part where you, when you're 10 years sober, it talks about it's in the chapter to the newcomer, right when we're new. Arguments and fault-finding should be avoided by the plague, like the plague. And rule two, make the other person feel important. That was a definition of love. If you want to show love to somebody, just make them feel important. Now to me, that's kind of easy. That's easier than loving somebody. So it had to begin with an understanding for me. Again, I'm back to the fact I don't want, it took me, what I wanted to say was it took me 7 months of AA meetings before I could quit drinking. During that time I gave up the narcotics, and at the end of 7 months of coming to these meetings, I was finally able to accept the idea that I had a drinking problem, that it was probably a serious problem, and I might even be a kind of an alcoholic, but I wasn't a drunk like a lot of the people. Somehow it was very important for me to distinguish between being an alcoholic and being a drunk. I'm not so sure today what the difference is, but it was very important to me at that time. And it was acceptance of that fact, acceptance of the fact that that's my handicap in life. I can't drink like other people. What's your handicap? And don't you feel sorry for me. When I accepted my alcoholism and accepted that as a fact of life for me and was willing then to say, well, now what am I going to do about it?
When I stopped fighting the disease, accepted the disease, and began to live in the answer instead of living in the problem ceased to be a problem. And I never ceased to be amazed at how easy it is for me today to not do the thing that I found absolutely impossible. There was nothing I could do. I didn't even get into all the things I tried to try to stop drinking back at a time when I realized I had a drinking. I tried antabuse, like somebody said. Every morning I very conscientiously took the antabuse, and every night I conscientiously took the antidote and drank. I said that in a meeting one time, and some other conscientious alcoholic said, "What's the antidote?" You know. I drank at home. I used to lock my bar so that I had folding doors on it. A walk-up bar had folding doors on it. I bought a lock and a hasp, and I locked myself out of my bar. And I did the logical thing with the key. I gave it to Max so we could fight over it every night. I'd argue with her until she'd get us one drink, and she'd have her drink and go to bed, and I'd have my drink and then try to get more, and I'd try to find the lock, and she'd hide it better, and I got to where I tried to pick the lock, and I'd lay there on the floor, and I'd pick, because I had the lock about that far from the floor, and I'd pick, and I'd pick, and I'd pick, and I'd pick. And I'd finally think, whose goddamn bar is this anyway? And I ripped the lock off, you know. And it was when I couldn't quit that I decided I didn't have a drinking problem. And I ended up, against my better judgment, in AA, and I didn't stop drinking until I accepted. Acceptance of my disease seemed to be the answer for me. Acceptance was the key to sobriety. And acceptance is the key to serenity for me. Because if I'm unhappy today, it's because some person, place, thing, or situation is unacceptable to me. And I'm going to stay uncomfortable until I accept that. That that's the way it's supposed to be. That that's the way that person is supposed to be. If I'm a child of God, then that person is a child of God. And if I don't like that person, I'm telling God I don't like his handiwork. That I know better than he how he should have that person be. I've made a terrible mistake. I've done this before. I got up to talk for an hour, and I forgot to look and see what time it was when I started talking, so I have no idea how long I've talked. So I'm going to sit down. But before I do, one of the things I've noticed so much in AA, before AA, I knew everything, whether it's right or wrong. And I knew all the answers, and if I didn't know, I knew where to go to get them. Things were either black or white. It was one or the other. It was no shades of gray. And I've heard a lot of pitches in AA. I've talked to a lot of people, and I've seen some people that are really bad. But I've never yet seen the person who was so bad that there wasn't an awful lot of good in them. And I've certainly seen a lot of good people in AA. But I haven't seen a single person that is so good that there isn't some bad in them. And I've come to the conclusion that as long as this is earth and not heaven, no person, no thing, no place, no situation is going to be entirely good or entirely bad. There's good and bad in everything and everybody. I wasn't aware of that before. As a matter of fact, I was born with a particular genius for being able to see the flaw in everything. And I was only too glad to tell you because I knew you wanted to know. You know? And with sobriety, you know, I have a choice. I have a choice today. I didn't before. I have a choice as to whether I look at the good or look at the bad. And either way, I'm right. I can. It's why people who smile always have something to smile about. And people who complain always have something to complain about. Either way, you're right. But today I have the choice as to which I focus my attention on. I can look for the good with people. I can either enjoy the good and ignore the bad. And with my health, I can either focus on how good it is and feel better, or I can focus on how bad it is and feel worse. And I can focus on what a good day it is and watch it get better, or I can focus on what a crummy day it is and watch it get worse. I have a choice. I didn't have those choices. I had a lot of choices today that I never had before. I'm just delighted to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It just, I don't know what an alcoholic is. I do know that nobody else knows either. They'll even admit they don't know, and then they'll go on and explain you to them and imply that you're just neurotic or you can't cope or whatever, or that you picked the wrong parents. I don't know. Well, that's not true. I do know how I became an alcoholic. I don't talk about it. I'm too humble. But because you're such a nice audience, I'll tell you, if you promise not to tell anybody. Essentially, it turns out that, you know, where people are made, there's a line from which everybody who drinks comes out a certain assembly line, and there's a little man that stands there, and every tenth one he stamps alcoholic, alcoholic, alcoholic. I got stamped, and it took a long time to find it. For years, I was convinced that the worst possible thing that could ever happen to a nice guy like me would be that I turn out to be alcoholic. And it turns out to be the best thing that's ever happened to me. Best thing that's ever happened to me. I've never had it so good. In fact, being an alcoholic is such a fantastic idea. I'm really amazed I didn't think of it myself. Thank you all very much.
You're fantastic.